What's up, guys? I'm Tyler Hosley, and watching Regina George spit in Evelyn from the mummy's mouth is my new favorite fetish.
Yeah, standard. Should have seen that coming, team. Should have seen that coming, but I appreciate you clarifying that right at the start.
Yeah, I thought everyone would like to know right away.
Yeah. I'm Kevin Matthews, and I have crossed oceans of time to be here. Well, I just waited a week and came back up to the cinema room to record, but it sounded better the Dracula way.
I'm Dave Gray, and for some reason this past week I've been living my life in moody, neon-drenched montages, and this is Raiders of the Podcast.
Yeah.
Besides the movies for the podcast this week, I saw some weird stuff. I watched another romance on Netflix. I watched Words Bubble Up Like Soda Pop, which is, I think it came out last year, anime romance about two very introverted teens who meet and have a little summer getting to know each other. They find a missing record, and it's adorable. I adored it. It's only like an hour and a half, so if you got a little bit of time to spare, you should totally slot it in. It's a solid Kevin 7, but hey. This might be one I'd rate over Kevin 7. I might give this a solid 8. It's really cute. The two leads have very relatable issues in how they deal with the world around them. I adored it. I was really surprised. Besides that, I watched so many bad horror movies this week. I'm not even sure if I can remember all of them. I watched, I can't even remember what I watched anymore. They all kind of blur together.
Did you watch something, was like Cold Crook Manor or something?
I did. I watched, it's Camp Coldbrook.
All right. Okay.
It has, Chad Michael Murray and Danielle Harris, and it was produced by Joe Dante. So I was like, yeah, going in, this might be a good thing. This might be some solid entertainment, and guess what? It wasn't. It was really bad. Like, I don't know how the director scammed these people into being in his movie and connected to it, but it was just really dull, because it did the setup with the, oh, hey, it's a ghost hunting show doing their last big hurrah, and guess what? There's real ghosts at this one. Harris and Chad Michael Murphy both try really hard to make it work, but it doesn't. It's poorly made. It's poorly shot. The script is atrocious. There's no scares. Even Kevin could guess the twist coming a mile away, and that isn't like an insult towards Kevin. That is just realizing that he is not the best at guessing movies. I understand that.
Yeah. I understand that. I've said that before myself. If I can see a twist coming, it's not a very sort of well hidden twist.
Yeah, it's just so. You know, it's just it does everything you basically expect it to, and then you just kind of go, "Oh, okay, that was a movie I watched." The other one worth mentioning that I watched was Pledge Night, which has Joey Belladonna of Anthrax as a supernatural killer back from the dead on a pledge night at a fraternity. It's not great, but it was an enjoyable little diversion. So if you got, you know, you want something a little unusual starring the singer of Anthrax, there you go. I mean, it's not good. I'm not going to go, oh, it's a great slasher entry in the oeuvre. No, it's an okay little 1990 slasher. It's fine for what it is. Goofy, like the pranking each other and the Greek life thing was kind of fun. You know, it's just garbage, but it's garbage you can watch with your brain off and kill a couple hours with. I watched other things, but they're just not worth talking about, if I'm honest. The kind of stuff that just don't leave much impression.
Does that include Blood Red Sky? I couldn't remember if you'd watched
no.
that.
Everybody disliked that so much that I went, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going there.
I don't dislike it that much, but I didn't give it a Kevin 7. It scraped into a Kevin 6.
Ooh.
So, you know, that's.
I think Chris hated it. Damning it enough. So, and he's pretty generous to horror movies, so I kind of went, okay.
It's definitely, you know, it just could have done stuff to make it more fun. And it's another film that clocks in at about 2 hours. It doesn't need to be. There's so many films now that, like, I don't want to get militant about it, but there are so many films now that are 2 hours or over that just really don't need to be. It's bad enough with all the superhero movies because most of them need another 50 minutes of sneakily inserted origin story in there just in case you didn't know how this superhero came to be born amongst this briar patch and then burst out. But everything from the sci-fi stuff to the horrors that are coming along, like now I'm at the point, if I see something's 90 minutes, I'm sitting there already giving a small round of applause, like, good for you. You do that. That's well done. Which is how I ended up watching Joel in a fairly optimistic mood.
I did watch that. That one I watched. Yeah, Jolt.
You didn't seem to hate it. Like,
No, I just totally forgot about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, not only managed a Kevin 6. I like Beckinsale. I could see how the ending was going to play out there, so wasn't that sort of well hidden. But Stanley Tucci's there, which helps. The humor was good. But I couldn't help thinking they've taken this idea of, you know, her with the belt to shock her when she's about to lose the rag, basically, and did nothing with it. When I saw the trailer, I thought, right, this is going to go wrong. Now, I'm obviously not a Hollywood screenwriter or otherwise, but I was just sort of thinking, why couldn't there be, you know, either something that goes wrong with the vest and it's wired into her and then she's still trying to chase bad guys, but also having to violently evade anybody else that's in the way that doesn't deserve it, or, you know, for a large part of the film, have somebody else in control of the vest. And you have the same dilemma when there are innocent people nearby. Barely does anything with innocent people imperiled nearby. And that could have been a factor to help it sort of maintain some thrills and tension. But maybe I was overthinking it. I wanted a bit too much from it. It was just a week of films that were generally okay that I'd heard some mixed reviews about from our people, because I also watched Werewolves Within. That got a Kevin 6. I don't want to turn it to Kevin 6. I'm happy with my Kevin 7 status. But Werewolves Within, for me, it wasn't funny enough with the comedy side. It didn't have enough emphasis on the werewolf element. And then I didn't care about the mystery side of things. It's based on a game that I haven't played. It didn't even stop at the end to have a werewolf break, which I would have appreciated. Should have done that. The cast were good. The cast really helped sell it. There's the guy who plays the lead, Sam Richardson. I really liked him. And Milana Vaintrup, I think it's how you pronounce his name, who plays the postal worker, Cecily, that he meets in town. I really liked her. But generally, like, if you're after something werewolfy, check out The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which I can understand people would watch that and be like, well, it's not a werewolf film. I get it. But it is, I would say, a better, quirky riff on werewolf films. And there's also the excellent Game of Werewolves, which was also called something like Lobos de Agra. That was from about, I want to say about 2012. A really excellent werewolf-filled horror comedy. That's, I mean, it's the rare kind of film I will wholeheartedly recommend to werewolf movie fans. I can't see anybody being disappointed with that. Have you guys seen Game of Werewolves? I feel like I've asked this before.
I have not.
You have, and I have, but it's been it's been a while.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, and the werewolf design in that is, I believe, sort of in line with the kind of the Paul Naschy werewolf look. It's a very good look. Just a couple more ago, I watched a documentary about Valerie Taylor playing with sharks, which was, I really enjoyed it. I think over the years, specifically relating to Jaws, everyone celebrates Jaws and the look of the film and the end result. But Ron and Valerie Taylor did a lot of the work to capture the shark footage there. And, you know, throughout their lives, they did some stuff, showcase sharks as a danger of the sea, and then they felt quite guilty at the backlash that had come around and were working to try and protect them. That's what this shows anyway. Valerie Taylor started off as a kind of a spear hunter in competition and then wanted to move on to photographing marine life and was working with sharks. It's just really good. I think their names are forgotten more nowadays than they should be. I mean, I remember having a book years ago, and it was like the diaries of Ron and Valerie Taylor while they were trying to get the right shots for Jaws. And it was a really good book, and their input into that movie is as important as so many other parts of it. Last, but by no means least, I managed a little bit of homework this week, I think, for the first time in a long time, but I revisited True Romance. And I fucking love True Romance. I can't remember the last time I watched it, but it's up there with the best of Tarantino's work. I think Tony Scott was the perfect match for it directorially. The cast assembled is fantastic. And it just has a better balance of tangents and moments that are cinematic without the overindulgence that Tarantino gives to himself when he's doing his own material. Slater and Arquette are a great on-screen couple. That confrontation between Hopper and Walken is still an all-time great moment, but there are so many great moments in there. And I miss main movie roles for Bronson Pinchot. I think he's great in True Romance, and I've seen him in a number of roles where he would just steal a scene or two. And I've always been a fan of his. Yeah, I love it. Thoughts on True Romance?
Bronson Pinchot?
Yeah.
Dude, no.
What?
That cocaine bit is hysterical in the car, though. Oh my god, I love that fucking movie.
There was that. There was obviously Beverly Hills Cop, Aquel, and I think I saw. I can't remember. It was called like The Great American Sex Scandal or something. It was this spoof, sort of. It was probably a TV movie about this sensational trial, and he was there. He might have had multiple roles, but one of them was a reporter just selling it on the sheer sex of it. And it was very funny. And yeah, I've always tended to enjoy his comedic turns.
Let's see. I tried to do some more romantic homework, and I only ended up getting like two viewings. That wasn't a romance movie. Well, one was, one wasn't. That wasn't from the four this week. I watched another Rachel McAdams romantic drama, The Vow, which I actually liked a lot, actually. It's pretty sweet, and McAdams and Channing Tatum are both really good in it. It's complete, sappy, bullshit, and I just enjoyed it for what it is. Complete sappy romantic bullshit. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff, what can I say? And I enjoyed it. Plus, I really like Channing Tatum and Rachel McAdams, which you're about to hear a little bit more about Rachel McAdams shortly. And on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from that movie, I watched Feral State, which I blind bought based on its fucking plot. White trash. It takes place in Central Florida. Group of kids robbing people. And I hated it. It was fucking awful. It was the most boring movie I've watched all year. And this is the same week where I enjoyed a sappy romance movie over a white trash youth gone bad movie. So,
holy shit. Whoa. Plot twist.
The end is nigh.
How can you mess up something that takes place in Central Florida, white trash, bad kids, and me hate it? Well, this movie fucking did. It's really boring, guys. And it's got Anna Lynn McCord, who I normally love, but she's terrible in it. So it's a terrible movie, and don't waste your time.
Wow.
I love that you're earnestly trying to make sure David and I don't seek out as if we were and ever going to.
No, are you kidding me? He basically guaranteed I'm going to look for it now.
Like, so bad.
Like, I'm not going to go like out of my way, but if I ever see it, I'm going to be like, that's going on my watch list.
I'm just staying far away from that.
Well, it's available at Walmart right now if you want to buy it for $12. No, I did.
I don't. I'll wait until it's on, like, you know, Tubi or some shit. This week, we got our romance on with 1991's independent drama, My Own Private Idaho. 1992's gothic horror, Bram Stoker's Dracula. 2000's Hong Kong drama, In the Mood for Love. And 2017 drama, Disobedience. I'm going to go first. And I'm going to go with not my least favorite, but the movie I have the least to say anything about, Bram Stoker's Dracula. You know, it's Francis Ford Coppola's take on the classic 1897 novel with Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, Anthony Hopkins, and Keanu Reeves, as well as Billy Campbell, who was the Rocketeer, Cary Elwes, and the always dependable Richard E. Grant. You know, they all deserve a little name drop because they're all equally whatever in this movie. Instead of just being a vampire, they do add on a heavier connection to the real Vlad Dracul of Romania, who defended his homeland against the Turks. Although in this version, his wife Elisabetta commits suicide after falsely reading of his death. You'd think you'd check that stuff out back then. If somebody shot an arrow message into my wall that said, Kevin is dead, I wouldn't, like, replace him with Anna right away. I'd email him first. I'd be like, hey, Kevin, are you dead? And then when he got back to me, no, I'd be like, oh, Tyler, you bastard. Fool me once.
You would have replaced me within a minute. You would ignore the second arrow that was shot in that just said, lol. And that would be me bumped from the podcast.
That's not true. I'd totally check. It is actually, except for the love angle and a few things tied to that, it's actually a fairly relatively close to the book, but nothing Dracula is really all that close to the book. It does take the conceit of diaries and stuff. This film is gorgeous. I mean, the production design is amazing. I remember when it first came out, there was actually a book that was published, a giant coffee table hardback book that took up a big center specialty space in the bookstore my mom was the manager of. And it was gorgeous, and it's still gorgeous to this day. The costumes and the set design are immaculate, and the physical effects are fantastic. I mean, you don't get to see many of them that often, but like the wolf creature and the bat creature Dracula is are gorgeous. I mean, they are magnificent. The musculature armor he has in the opening scene is amazing. I mean, the costuming, all that stuff is just fantastic. Tragically, everything else in this movie is not. The screenplay is not great. It's fine for a Dracula adaptation, but where this movie really kind of bumbles is the whole cast is not good. I remember when this came out, Ryder and Reeves got a real kicking, but that's kind of bullshit because Anthony Hopkins' German accent is terrible. Gary Oldman is literally just doing an impersonation of Bela Lugosi, but not Bela Lugosi when he was Dracula, Bela Lugosi when he's strung out as hell and appearing in Ed Wood films. The children of the night, what beautiful music they make. I never drink wine. And it's like, okay, yeah, okay, that's fine, that's fun and all. But then they have Billy Campbell talk like fucking Elvis. Oh, Miss Lucy, I'm all shook up when you touch my knife. Oh, oh, Richard E. Grant, I have no idea what the fuck he's doing through half of it. He's just, I guess they decided Seward was an addict on his own supply because he's kind of strung out. I think there is a scene where he shoots up and he kind of writhes for a second.
Well, I'm still very impressed by your impressions. I say we just cut the review aspect and we do an audio play version with you doing all the roles.
I'd do it. I'd totally do it.
Well, I know English. Count, I have come to the countryside.
And I'll just wait. All I want to do is, I know where the bastard sleeps.
I know where the bastard sleeps. Dude. Lucy, I am here because we are friends, Lucy.
I mean, everybody's accent is atrocious except for Cary Elwes because he's the only person speaking in his natural accent. And again, production-wise, they do some neat stuff. I mean, Coppola is obviously hardcore into the source material here, or the screenplay at least, because they do some interesting stuff. Like they talk about how when he's in the daylight, the vampire's underpowered. So when we first see Dracula in daylight, they do a hand cranked effect, which is pretty awesome. They abandon it once Mina shows up. But, you know, I mean, it's just, it's like, it's got so many nice bits in it that you almost kind of forget how terrible the whole cast is. Cause they're all just chewing the scenery like crazy, like salivating all on it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that at least, Anthony Hopkins needed some dental work afterwards cause that stone does not look like it's good to gnaw on. I mean, I'm sure he got some micro fissures in his teeth and shit. But as far as, you know, Dracula adaptations go, it's fine. It's not great. It's not the best. It's not the worst. It's just a nice middle of the road Dracula adaptation that kills 2 hours of your time with some pretty visuals. There's just not much to say about it. Except to do the accents.
I fear that my letters have, like, totally forsaken me and sealed my fate. Dude.
I really like Dracula, and honestly, and this is no exaggeration, this might have one of the single best set designs of any horror film ever. And that's like no exaggeration. I truly think this has a fucking amazing, amazing set design. It's stunning to fucking look at. And the costume design and Coppola's camera work is just fucking stellar. The actual in-camera visual effects, the colors, the editing, I love how over-the-top erotic it is. I've seen this movie so many times over the years, and the look of Dracula's castle is still fucking mind-blowing. Just on a technical level, this movie really is fucking perfect. Where the flaws come in is some of the acting, though. Keanu, who I love dearly, is pretty fucking weak overall. He's just doing Keanu straight from Bill and Ted. Cary Elwes is never good. That man is just never good. Winona Ryder.
Lies. Lies. There's a movie called The Princess Bride, and you are a liar, sir.
Which I have never seen. So I can't say. I've never fucking seen that movie.
What?
I'm scared to watch it because I keep thinking it's going to be like Willow or something. And I just, yeah. fantasy and 80s just don't do it for me. But I will watch it eventually because you'll probably make me.
Oh, now. You're damn straight I will.
Yeah. The cast. Oh, yeah, the cast. Winona Ryder is just kind of meh. I mean, she's okay. I don't dislike her in the role. I just think anybody else could have played that role better. She's perfectly acceptable. But someone would have definitely played that better. I actually like Anthony Hopkins. I thought he was good. I like Tom Waits as Renfield. I actually love Gary Oldman as Dracula in this, even though I'll never be able to not hear Junkie Bela Lugosi when Oldman talks now. Thanks, Dave.
It's true.
It really fucking is. God damn it, it's ruined. It's ruined now. But still like that performance. But like I said, it does have its share of issues. But the good totally outweighs the bad for me on this one. It's a gorgeous, big-budget gothic romance. The kind of film we don't see very often anymore. And I love it for that. I've always enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I like Dracula. But I was wondering if I might love it on this revisit. It's been a long time since I've seen it. Can't disagree that it's a gorgeous film to look at. Can't disagree that a lot of the cast are quite bad. It's the way they're encouraged to put on the accents and work with them and deliver the dialogue that, I mean, it's a very unexciting, mopey film when it moves away from the actual, you know, skeleton of the Dracula plot that we know. So when you get all the love story stuff, it grinds to a halt. It's a big, you know, potential romance there, and it waits watching what these two ill-fated maybe lovers will get up to, between Oldman and Ryder. It has that, but then it does have the impressive, design work everywhere. And has the fantastic effects. I always love that transition. The creature backing off and then turning into all the rats. I think that's just a superb moment in this film. And all of the big kind of creature effects are superb. But I've always loved that bit. It's just so odd and it works really well. What struck me this time was everyone involved, despite the level of sort of seriousness that's given to the plot and the content, it's as if Coppola got the cast by saying, look, we're basically going to do this kind of panto style. And that's the performance level he went to draw from everyone. Like, the only person who doesn't, I would say, really go panto style is Oldman, but we can all agree now that he's doing, you know, drug Lugosi from the Ed Wood movies. But he picks that to aim for and sticks to that pretty well. And he's helped by the costume design in that as well, as everyone has. But Ryder, Reeves, Richard E. Grant, out of his nut. Is a lot of fun. Waits as a highlight as the bug eater. But yeah, the leads, feel like they're in panto or just like they're maybe in live theater, but not used to it. So overdoing everything. And then you get Hopkins, who's clearly just being allowed to cut loose and have fun. And he is fun. Like, he brings the energy level up in the film. Whenever he's on screen, it's a fun performance, but it doesn't feel like a proper performance for a Van Helsing in a Dracula movie that was purporting to be this, like, serious, more literal take on the material. With the added love story in that, that was just put in there. So it's very strange, a strange experience watching these actors do things this way as they've obviously been directed to do. But so many great individual moments. I do like the first scenes between Harker and Dracula in the castle. I do like the scenes with the brides, not just because Monica Bellucci is one of them, but he gets some enjoyably dark moments with younger snacks in this film. One with the brides and one with Lucy at one point, who's also, I think, well played by Sadie Frost. I think Sadie Frost is really good in her role here. So it's a good one to watch because of the production values, because of the some of the soundtrack choices. That's the other thing, the score. I like the score when it worked with the scenes, but it didn't always work in each scene. So sometimes I was getting annoyed by the score. It was just really hit and miss. Wasn't that the music being presented itself was bad, but on a scene-by-scene basis, there are some scenes where it really works, especially when kind of, I would say, events are building towards a crescendo in the same way that the music was. And there are other scenes where it's almost like the stuff on screen doesn't match what the music was trying to sort of underline or represent. So it's a real mixed bag, but a beautiful one to sit back and absorb if you want to for a couple of hours. I will actually bat the ball back to Dave, because next up is In the Mood for Love, one of two picked by Dave, and directed by Wong Kar-wai, starring Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung, if I've pronounced those names right. They basically both within a day or two of one another both move into different rooms in an apartment block, and they are both married. They eventually realize that their spouses are potentially having an affair, very possibly with one another, and they have a closeness and an intimacy that they enjoy, but also try to step back from. Say that's a pretty fair summation of this. Another way to say it is that In the Mood for Love basically feels like a riff on Brief Encounter. It's very much a modern take on that. Dave had two choices this week. You got lucky with the roll of the dice. And this one is like one of my favorite romance movies of all time. It's astonishingly good for every minute. It's one of those films that I can't really put into words everything I like about it. The feeling of the time and the place, is it, I can't recall now though, is it sort of 60s Hong Kong?
Yeah, it's
Shanghai.
I think the first, because there's a couple time periods it jumps into. I think it's 62 Shanghai, and then 64, and then 66 or 67.
Shanghai.
Yeah. Well, except for the one scene in, oh crap, where is it?
It's. Yeah, it just, while you're watching it anyway, it has the environment they're in and the time they're in just all feels spot on. The characters are it's not that the characters are necessarily beautifully sketched out, although they are, but they're, it's more that they're beautifully sketched out in their relationship with one another, how that is, you know, a brief encounter here and there, and then have moments of becoming closer and spending more time together, and, you know, the discussions about what their spouses could be up to. It's pretty much a modern masterpiece. I love the ending, which I'm not going to spoil for anyone, but it's beautiful. I like the soundtrack, and, you know, I know it sounds obvious and it's kind of what the song's about, but the refrain of perhaps, 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 works really well with this. And at some point, I don't know if you'll be shocked to hear this, Dave, but I did see 2046 a year or two ago, which is a kind of sequel to this. And I also really like that, even though it's not as good as In the Mood for Love. It's quite a different kind of look at potential paths through life and storytelling devices. I would recommend 2046 to people just if they're, you know, interested in Wong Kar-wai's movies, and why wouldn't you be? But In the Mood for Love is the best.
Yeah, but any Wong Kar-wai film is worth checking out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, yeah, for the record.
Well, I don't think I've seen any others. I've still not seen, like, Chungking Express.
Dude!
I don't think. And I was looking through his filmography in a week. I'm like, yeah, not seen that, not seen that, not seen that. So, bizarrely, it's just In the Mood for Love that I'd seen before, and 2046, I think. I mean, I may be forgetting something, but certainly none of his hits. Yeah, I love this, Dave. This was a warm and fuzzy glow-making revisit.
He did My Blueberry Nights, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, he that. Did that, and Arrows might be his two weakest films, but yeah, he did that one.
I've seen that one because I have a love for everything Natalie Portman, so yes, I have seen that one. Shockingly, I have never seen this before. I watched this like not even 24 hours ago, and I'm still trying to kind of digest what I just watched. Like, I still don't have my complete thoughts put together, so this is going to be kind of a mess and all over the place, but bear with me. It's very elegant. It's gorgeous. The costumes are fucking amazing. I love its use of red. Every single shot in this movie looks like a fucking painting. I mean, it's very slow, yes, glacially paced, yet not once did I ever feel bored. The two leads are great and have this, like, beautiful on-screen chemistry. Like, I don't think I've ever wanted an on-screen couple to be a couple in real life as much as these two. I mean, their chemistry is just fucking perfect here. I love its early 60s setting. It's romantic poetry caught on film. I mean, that's easily the best way I could accurately describe this movie at this very moment. I hardly took any notes because I legit couldn't take my eyes off the screen to actually write down any fucking notes. So, but yeah, just definitely another favorite Dave pick here. And I will definitely be watching this again very soon in the very near future. So, excellent pick, Dave. This was really fucking good.
Yeah, be sure to watch 2046 also. You will love that one, T.
Nice.
Yeah, I adore this movie. I brought two monsters this week. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm just going to go all out, and I did. In the Mood for Love is a legit masterpiece. It's shot like a noir. vibrantly colored and saturated. It uses recurring visual motifs. Nothing changes except these two characters' feelings. These are two characters who in any other movie would be, they'd be background while we focused on the affair, where the cheating spouses would be the ones front and center, not these two. And they have an emotional affair, even if it's not physical, but it's beautiful. This is one of the most heartbreaking films I have ever seen. It's rare to see something approach romance and relationships the way that this film does. And it's very, well, it's beautiful. It's poignant. It's very relatable. It's not about, you know, succeeding. It's not even about unrequited love, because it is requited. It's about the choice of not taking that step, even when both want it. Even when no one would blame you for doing it. But sometimes in life you have those relationships. You have to, you know, not go down that corridor, and you can come close. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely heartbreaking. I love everything about this film. The music, they repeat the same music and it's all excellent. The angles, the clock, the design is easily up there with Dracula for some of the best ever put on film. It's just, you're transported to this period and it's perfect. It's picture perfect. You know, I wasn't alive then, but in my head, this is how I picture it. There's all these unspoken things between every moment that are heartbreaking. Even before they start hanging out, there's these wonderful moments of their loneliness building that are just, I mean, the performances, and most of it's without dialogue, are just delivered in a way that's almost, it's a physical delivery that you just feel on levels that don't get tapped into very often. I also don't have many notes because, this is a film I've watched a bunch, but every time it's on, I just kind of get involved, and the era it's about, and the last couple scenes about the fallout from it after it's passed. And the last scene's in, or it's in Cambodia. I don't know why I don't even remember where I said now. It's at Siam Reap and Angkor Wat. It's just, it's wonderful. Just the whisper into the hole just kind of caps it all together. I adore this movie, and I'm not going to lie. All four movies this week were good, but there's some that just are another level. And for me, In the Mood for Love is another level. If you haven't seen it, it's streaming on Criterion Channel and HBO Max, and you owe it to yourself to watch it. I mean, that's it. At this point, you've just got yourself to blame if you don't see it, because it's some next level shit. It is amazing. T-Pick Disobedience, the 2017 drama film directed by Sebastian Lelio and co-written by Lelio and Rebecca Lankowitz, based on a 2006 novel by Naomi Alderman. Rav Krushka succumbs while delivering a sermon on free will to his northern London Jewish Orthodox congregation. Ronit, the Rav's estranged daughter, who lives in New York as a photographer, returns to London. There she reunites with childhood friend Dovid and his wife, another childhood friend, Esti. We learn that Ronit left the community because of being caught in a romantic tryst with Esti, and Esti is living a lie. The book is excellent, and very much gets into how their faith plays into things. I don't think the movie quite lands in a lot of ways. Rachel Weisz Rachel McAdams and Alessandro Nivola.
That's right.
Yeah, is that right?
I'm still waiting for you to ask Muir Tyler if we read the book.
No, I know you haven't. I've read the book.
I know, but it's tradition that you ask.
Have you read the book?
Of course not, Dave. Of course not.
No, sir.
Well, in the book, something that actually makes more sense is Dovid is Rannet's cousin, and he's the one that calls her back. Actually, Dovid is far more accepting and open and instrumental in the book. Actually, and their Jewishness is a much bigger thing in the book. This is part of my problem with the movie, where a lot of it feels like instead of getting into their faith, it's kind of, I mean, yeah, it's a movie, so it's going to be performative no matter what, but it feels like they kind of just half-assed moments. Like, I'm not Jewish, but I know the menorah in the rabbi's office has the wrong number of branches. I know they misuse the names for God. They use the wrong ones at the wrong times. They say, what is it? They keep using the same expression over and over and over, which I know in the U.S. they don't use at all, and in South African groups it's only used at funerals, but they use it so much that it's kind of like they basically want them to be saying live long and prosper. It's weird how they approach the community, because it's not approached honestly or openly. It's very much approached with a shorthand where you're going to go, oh, well, it's an awful, you know, misogynistic group anyway, so whatever. And to be fair, yeah, there's a lot of misogyny in these Orthodox enclaves. But their religion is very big in these characters, and it's kind of glossed over in the film to be just more set decoration. I don't buy the romance between Esty and Ronit. It's very much just... we're watching the aftermath 20 years later instead of the actual romance itself. I found the sex scene to be a bit too Pornhub-y. I mean, they literally spit in Ronit spits in her mouth. And that's not a Tinder romance thing. That's a domination thing. That's a thing you get because you've watched too much Pornhub instead of, you know, actually having an open and honest conversation. They take away the denouement from Esty and they give it to Dovid, which doesn't make sense. It's an okay movie. I just don't think it lands as well as it should or as well as it could. And, instead of watching the movie, you should just read the book because it's better all around. There's some good performances here. It's not well made. It's not a good screenplay. It's way too on the nose. I mean, using The Cure's love song right before they start kissing again is just, it's a little insulting. It's a little too on the nose. It's a little fucking incompetent and half-assed. I mean, again, overall, I think the movie's okay. It's got three very strong performances, but it should be better than it is. It should be more than it is. And instead, it's just kind of checking boxes so it doesn't have to really put in the effort. And that's my problem. Ultimately, it's just kind of there.
Unsurprisingly, I guess, I liked it a bit more than you, Dave. But, like, not by much. I don't think it does the relationship stuff well. Well, I say relationship. I don't think it does that well with the physical side of things that are shown. Kind of agree with you. There's certainly a filter there that is working against it. And then, I mean, also, like, you know, none of us here are prudish, but I think the one main scene between Vice and McAdams here feels out of place in a film that I thought got a lot of the other elements right. I like the different conflicts that Vice was facing. I like she was at one point particularly, she was almost being attacked on all fronts for different aspects of her life, whether it was, you know, having the kind of cheek to not have children to further the line, or how she wasn't close enough to her father and there for him during his last days, how she didn't adhere, you know, as closely to the tenets of the faith as other people wanted her. I really liked that, and I liked all that coming together and showing how strong she had to be to just cope with getting through these moments and this time, even when her own priority, at least initially, was to be there to sort of do her duty as a daughter and you know, see off her father. Like, that's it. And get everything sorted. That's what she wanted. I really liked that. I don't think, it's not necessarily her fault. I don't think McAdams is as well cast as Esty. And there's a problem with how her character sort of pushes up more and more, with Vice's character and how they lead towards the third act. It just never felt as organic enough as it should be, or it didn't feel like McAdams' character had, would really have still had that kind of fire in her belly or that motivation. Although she has, you know, one or two good moments where she sort of highlights the fact that she's settled for a certain way of life. But making McAdams very dowdy in this role and having her in that triangle as it's placed didn't really feel right. She's the one that felt most out of place. Nivola, I thought was excellent, and I had to do a double take when he came on. Thought he was doing good, with the, like, they were all playing kind of British, I guess. He was doing good there. He did well with the one or two speeches that he had. And I generally like the ending of this. Although I have to admit that it's, you know, not completely earned, not really earned at all, but it's boosted mainly by Vice and Nivola, which is just somehow enough to really make that work for me. And so, like, I did enjoy this, and compared to the many ways in which Tyler has tortured us over the years, it was certainly more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Real quick, so, was I the only one distracted by the age difference between McAdams and everyone else? Like, she's a good decade younger.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe that's why they worked harder on trying to make her so dowdy and grey, almost. I didn't think about that. She felt out of place within that triangle. Certainly, I felt a bit of miscasting there. I do like McAdams. She didn't, you know, do any wrong here. She just never felt right in that role. I can't say I've seen anything else that I know of from Sebastian Lelo. Oh no, I tell a lie. I'd seen Gloria Bell, I think, which I didn't like. I think it was might have even been a remake of his own thing of Gloria. I wasn't a big fan of that, but there's enough there to make it an interesting watch, and for me to keep an eye out and try and remember Lelio's name and check out other stuff that isn't Gloria Bell either.
I mean, it's definitely a Kevin 7. Yeah, you know.
I mean, probably, yeah, for bringing the stuff together. As I say, for the stuff that it really concentrates on Vice's character and what you keep seeing her go through in so many different ways, I think was a really good, really good number of subjects to tackle all in the one form. And that's what pleasantly surprised me about it. It wasn't just about the potential love affair or the clash of, you know, trying to keep your faith in a modern world or family. It was all those things, and they all centered on Vice's character. And some people who were taking her to task on that, you just wanted to put in a corner of the room and slap them about the face. I mean, that's just not the way to say it. Some people try to be snide with her or try to just keep having their digs. You grew tired of them quickly, and then you're like, God, how does she keep relatively composed and not just want to reach over and strangle them?
So, yeah, this is actually one of my favorite romance films of the past few years. Me, personally, I'm like the least religious person on the planet, but I love movies that deal with a character's faith or someone struggling with one's faith, sexuality and faith. I just always gravitate towards films that deal with that particular subject matter. I always have. And it's very rare that you ever see a film show the Jewish community on screen. I mean, especially Orthodox. I mean, it may not get all things right when it comes to the religion itself, but I do respect it for at least trying to portray it. I thought it did somewhat try. I mean, I haven't read the book. I know the book must try way harder than this movie does, which I really should read that.
Oh, read the book. You will love the book.
Yeah, I really do need to read that book. But yeah, it may not get all things right when it comes to the religion itself, but I respect it for trying somewhat to portray it in some way on screen. Even though it really does play as more of a backdrop for the story than the central story itself. I'm actually at the opposite end of the spectrum from you guys with the relationship aspect of the film here. I thought Rachel McAdams was fantastic in this, as was Rachel Weisz. I really thought they had some excellent chemistry as well. The sex scene between the two, for me personally, actually felt erotic and real without ever feeling forced because of their chemistry. But that's just me. It's beautifully shot. It's like most of the movies, we get slow paced, but I think it fits the darker, bleak tone of the film incredibly well. I just really love this movie. It was in my top three of 2018, and I think I loved it even more this viewing. But I can see why it wouldn't work for a lot of people, and I really should read that book because I've heard it's amazing, and it's been on my read list for years, and that list just keeps fucking growing because I fucking hardly ever read anything anymore. So, I really love this movie a lot. And now we're on to Dave's pick, his final pick. And he really did fucking stack the deck hard this week. God damn, Dave. Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, which is about two best friends living on the streets of Portland as hustlers who embark on a journey of self-discovery and find their relationship stumbling along the way. And I think this is a loose adaptation of Henry IV as well, if I'm not mistaken. I go back and forth on what my favorite Gus Van Sant film is. His filmography is full of stuff I absolutely fucking adore, from Drugstore Cowboy to Paranoid Park to Die For to even the Psycho remake, which I am a huge defender of. But after this viewing of My Own Private Idaho, I can easily say at this very moment, this is probably my favorite of his work. This movie is just fucking incredible. It was also the very first Criterion release I ever bought, so yeah. On the opposite end of the spectrum from Dracula, Keanu is actually fucking amazing in this, and River Phoenix as well. May he rest in peace. That dude was fantastic in this movie. Just a wonderful, wonderful somber performance, and it's such a shame he never got to show what a true talent he actually was, because he was fucking amazing in this. I love how Van Sant's script kind of reworks Henry IV in a modern setting. I think he does it perfectly. The script is brilliant, and it's absolutely heartbreaking in a way Van Sant portrays the loneliness and self-discovery. That campfire scene is amazing. Just that whole scene felt like you were watching an actual conversation of real people on screen. Just very raw, very natural dialogue. It's definitely a passion project for Van Sant, and that shows through every single frame of this entire movie, from its melancholy tone to its two leads. I can't praise this film enough. It's honestly a fucking masterpiece, and yeah, Dave just went hardcore this week with fucking stacking the deck. So excellent job, Dave.
Well, you know, I'm never going to love this as much as Tyler. But I do really like this. It's up there in the selection of Gus Van Sant movies that I've seen. It's hard to sort of pin down what I like and sort of dislike about it, because I run hot and cold on it through a number of different scenes. Like the scenes with Udo Kier, I'm not really a big fan of those scenes. I think Kier is being, you know, Udo Kier as much in those scenes, and they don't really work for me. And then the scenes with, who's the street guy? Is it Bob? Bob was the sort of, the kind of leader, the elder street guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, played by William Reichert. Yeah, Reichert.
I'm relying on your pronunciation there. Thank you. I didn't really like his stuff and what circles around Dame then. Although that plays in nicely towards the very end, I never really liked that. So the stuff here I don't like, but then the performances of Reeves and Phoenix are so good, and they work really well together as well, that it lifts it up. And it kind of nicely weaves in between something that could be pretty grim and downbeat and something that's quite sort of dreamy and optimistic. That's how I view it anyway, although obviously there's a lot of cynicism that can go through a lot of the third act. I think it's great though, for what it does and for mixing in the elements of Henry IV and for taking these characters and giving them a narrative that's not quite fairy tale land. It's not quite The Lost Boys or like Fagin's Children, but it's definitely within that ballpark. And Van Sant has fun with those elements while managing to steer things back to, you know, a slight seriousness. There's always the risk of something bad about to happen. There's the potential for more danger just, you know, around every corner on any sort of isolated patch of highway. And he does really well with that. But it's definitely in no small part thanks to both Phoenix and Reeves, who I think are superb in the roles here. Absolutely superb. But yeah, I mean, I like this one, Dave, but you knew that the biggest fan of it would be Tyler. You stacking son of a bitch.
Yeah, man. I played a long game this week. But I do love My Own Private Idaho. It's a gorgeous film. It's well shot. Even using some cliche things like the clouds rolling by, work because they're done in a way that it grounds it to the characters. It does some, at the time, unique things that have become standard issue, like the magazines talking. Before that, in 91, maybe it had been done before. I can't think of any offhand, but now, you know, those kinds of exposition scenes are pretty common. I like how there's very much two narratives and they occupy their own space. When we're with the, you know, the hustlers, it's done very melodramatically Shakespearean because I feel they are communicating that's how Bob and the others view their existence as Shakespearean tragedies. And then when it's, you know, Scott and Mike on the road or just together, it's far more grounded because then we're looking at it through Mike's lens, which is very, you know, he doesn't hold many illusions about his life. So we have these two very different styles that go together. They shouldn't go together well, but they go together excellently. This is without a doubt for me, Van Zandt's best film by a long way. To Die For is like probably closest on its heels, but it's a good half lap back. You know, I mean, and everything after To Die For, let's just pretend they don't exist. Drugstore Cowboy might be a lap and a half behind, and then that's it. Forget the rest. Yeah, it's incredibly well made. The cast is all excellent. I do think that, Bob Pigeon, as played by William Reichert, is perfect. He's spot on. He is a mustache twirling, jokey Shakespeare character brought to life. If the person playing him wasn't Olivier, but some guy at a dinner theater in bumf fluff nowhere, you know, it's great. Udo Kier, I really enjoy as Hans, but he's a MacGuffin, you know? You run into him the first time so you can run into him the second time so you can get to point C. So, you know, it's a movie. You kind of got to go, okay, whatever. Keanu Reeves is great. He plays, you know, a Shakespearean villain shockingly well. Better than his other journeys into Shakespearean villaindom. River Phoenix, Mikey might be one of the best performances of that decade. The Phoenix himself disappears into this character that is just human and grounded and sympathetic and could be, you know, easy to ridicule, but instead he's, genre defining character in an avant-garde film. It's, you know, My Own Private Idaho is amazing. I don't double dip very often, and I've had this DVD since, I don't know, like 2005. It might be time to double dip for a 4K, because I'm guessing it's worth it, you know? It's a gorgeous film. It's incredibly well made. It's got some just fantastic performances. It's not streaming anywhere. Not for free. You can rent it. So, you know, if you haven't, you should do that. You should do that now. You know, this was a pretty good week, guys. I don't think any of them were bad films. Just, you know, two I liked more than the others. It's time to pick. And yeah, no, without reservation for me, it's In the Mood for Love.
Yeah. Like you said, great week, but it's so hard for me to choose anything over My Own Private Idaho, so that's the one I'm going with.
It's In the Mood for Love for me as well, so you still basically get to sweep your stacking, son of a bitch.
Yeah, I did. I trust me, I sat down and I thought long and hard about it, and no, I've been meaning to pick In the Mood for Love for a while, and then once we scheduled this one, I was like, okay, well, it'll wait for that. Then when I got the second pick, I was like, well, fine. If they're going to bring, you know, Keanu and fucking, you know, Unusual Romance, I can do that shit too in one. Boom. Challenge accepted. But next week, we're back to the normal, and it's you and Tyler's turn to pick, Kevin. So let's hear it.
Well, 1982, a TV movie. It was often asked about on the old IMDb message boards as one that people remembered but couldn't recall the title of. It is Don't Go to Sleep.
And I'm going with a movie directed by one of my heroes, a hero of mine who we haven't covered yet, whom I actually have tattooed right square on my wrist. I am going with the directorial debut of Fred Durst, The Education of Charlie Banks.
I've known that was coming for so long now.
Yeah, I forgot that was due to come.
Yeah, that's been in the wings.
It has. He's only got 3 movies in his filmography, but we may cover them all eventually.
May? Yes.
You can find us on Twitter at Raiders of the Pod. We're on Facebook, where we talk to ourselves sometimes, although the romance question is definitely getting more buzz than usual. We have an Instagram page, Raiders_of_the_podcast. We also have a YouTube channel where you can subscribe, like, and comment. And you can always email us at raidersofthepodcast@gmail.com.
As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me, guys. I'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
Oh, and just go watch In the Mood for Love. You know you want to.
And My Own Private Idaho.
Well, baby, now every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you. That's how I know you go on. Far across distance and spaces between us, you have.